For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
My name is Rex. That's Rex. And I have a story to tell you about what happened to me while I was riding my Harley on the Pacific Coast Highway. You ready? Okay. I heard a voice. And the voice said, "Rex, you've been a good boy. Do you get one wish?" And I knew right away what I was going to wish for. I said, "I want a bridge that I can take my Harley and ride from the Pacific Coast Highway to Hawaii. I mean, I've always wanted to be in Hawaii and ride my Harley over there. And, you know, well, if I'm getting the opportunity, that's what I asked for." So the voice said, "You know, I could do it, but it would take a lot of resources. And it's a pretty selfish request. I mean, come on, can't you think of something a little more altruistic?" So I thought, and I thought, and I said, "You know what? I know what I want. I want to be able to understand my wife. I want to know what she means when she says everything is fine and I know it's not. I want to know what's happening when she gives me the silence treatment. I want all men to understand their wives." And there's a long silence. And the voice said, "Do you want that bridge with one lane or two?" Ladies and gentlemen, that cute little story is not, I'm not here simply to make fun of clueless husbands or complicated wives, although many have done so, but I think is maybe the most important point of our whole conversation this morning, which is that I would argue our goal really is not to spend a tremendous amount of time trying to understand each other, our partners, our spouses, our friends. But more importantly, our job really is to figure out, what is our job? What are we supposed to do in a relationship to make this relationship stronger? And I think that's a big mistake that a lot of us make. We spend a lot of time and a lot of frustration, I guess, again, especially from the men, who very often are clueless about what's going on, trying to figure it all out. And that's not necessarily well-spent time. There's a lot of understanding. The little quiz you took helps us understand each other. But a lot of it has to do with me and what I have to do in this relationship to make it stronger, to make it better, to make it more vibrant, to make it more enjoyable. So I do appreciate, as I said before, all of you coming, spending the time here with us this morning. The plan for the next little while is for me to talk and give you an overview, an introduction of the five love languages, some stories, a Jewish spin, a Jewish approach to the five love languages. Probably about 25 minutes, half an hour. And then questions. Very interested in hearing your questions, hearing what you want to hear, what you want to talk about. That's very, very important and critical. Rabbi Heller has agreed to moderate the question and answers in the sense that there are index cards somewhere around that I'll ask my mom to pass out. And to as we're talking, if questions come to mind, please jot them down. Rabbi Heller will collect them. And then we'll discuss some of those questions. I apologize in advance if you don't get to all of those questions, but I certainly want to hear
that
talk
way
about.
I can ask my questions and claim they came from you.
There you go, incognito. One of those rabbi tricks, and really try and spend some time talking about what you want to talk about. Again, I want to thank Rabbi Heller for allowing this to happen, to encouraging this to happening. He's been pushing this particular book for years, I understand. And maybe during the Q&A, if there's interest, we could talk a little bit about the story and the history and why we came to this particular book. But he and I agree 1,000% that this is a very important book. Not everyone's going to fall in love with it the way that he and I did. But the idea, the model, I think is very important, very helpful for everyone. I also want to thank Jessica for helping put this together and the office staff. It's really very exciting to be here. And at the very end, I did bring copies of the book. There's a young couple, some of you may know, Danny and Melanie Frank, who made a donation to JMI, to our organization, to allow us to give out the book at different venues. So everyone's going to leave with a copy of the text. The author, Gary Chapman, very interesting fellow, had an opportunity to schmooze with him, asked the question that I suspect many of us are asking, and that is, why another book? I mean, if you go to Amazon, you go to a bookstore, you'll find thousands, literally thousands of books on relationships, on marriage, on dating, on all these types of issues. So he asks, why? Why is he writing another one? And he answers very succinctly by saying a lot of the book starts at the second step, at the second page, and they miss the first step. What he means by that is a lot of the books talk, and maybe you've heard a lot about communication skills, about imago therapy, for example, is very famous. Hendrix, very interesting, fascinating work. There's a lot of good stuff out there. But he argues, and I would agree, that they're missing the foundation to a certain extent. And therefore, based on his work, he works in a church, actually, in Raleigh-Durham, I think it is, and he, in his counseling experiences with couples, he has come up with this model, with this idea of the five love languages, of how we can express love to each other. So, before getting to his particular model, I want to just preface by saying that we see this in Jewish sources, we see this in scientific theory all the time, and that is, the simpler something is, usually the more true it is, and certainly the more usable it is. Again, we see this in a lot of different ways, and the Torah certainly makes this point, and again, science is coming to this realization that there are themes. There are certain themes that run through everything, that if you can identify that theme, you're on to something. And that a lot of different details, a lot of different seemingly disparate parts come together. When you can figure that out, you're really onto something and understanding something. So this book, I think, is simple and is really onto something very, very, very important. I think we all know, anecdotally, just from life, just from science, that one of our deepest needs is to feel loved, is to feel wanted, is to feel cared by people in our lives. And the frustration very often is how to do that. And there are many, many stories. The book is actually quite light reading. It's not into psychobabble and research-based stuff. There's room for that, but he's very into the stories. And anecdotally, he shows, and from my own counseling experience, I'm sure from your own lives, you see that very often we want to share and show love for each other, but we don't know how. We're somehow missing the mark. And that's really what the five love languages comes to address. So the five love languages, for those who are not familiar, let's go down the five love languages. The five languages of love, which I'll explain a little bit more in a moment, but just to get that out first, are words of affirmation. And again, you're getting the book soon, the list is on the back. But words of affirmation, sharing complimentary words with each other. The second is quality time, spending time with the person that you care about. Gifts, giving things to other people. Acts of service, doing for other people. And last but not least, physical touch. Those are the five love languages. So one more time again, words of affirmation, quality time, gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. So Chapman argues that every single human being feels loved and appreciated in all five ways. But there is a mamalushin, if you will. There's a language that, especially multilingual people, Americans often don't count, but multilingual people appreciate the fact that you, even if you speak two or four or five languages, you think in a language that you grew up with. You think there's a language that's more native, more natural to you than other languages. So he argues, although we all feel loved and appreciated in all five ways, but there's a language or two that rises to the top, that's more powerful, that's stronger, that just speaks to us more than the other languages. So that if that language is identified, and that language is spoken to you, you feel better. Your love tank, as he puts it, is filled by the deposits made in that language more than it's filled by the deposits made in other languages. So that if acts of service is your dominant language, and your spouse speaks that language to you, they take care of you, they do things for you, they make sure they do the errands, etc., the fact that they're not giving gifts or they're not spending the time may not be a big deal to you, because your main language is acts of service. So to identify that in your spouse, in your child, in anyone that you care about, and to speak that language is huge. Again, he's not advocating ignoring the rest, but to be able to figure out things aren't as warm as they could be right now. What can I do today or tomorrow to make them better? So the answer very often is figure out. know already, walking around with this understanding of what that person's love language is. Hey, I haven't gotten her. I haven't gotten him a gift in a while. That's one of their main languages. I'll stop on the way home, get something special, and that will really make a difference to my partner, to my spouse, to my child, to whoever. That's really the model in a nutshell. The irony, it's not an irony, it's really the way God planned the world. Spouses rarely speak the same language. You can understand that on different levels. But spouses rarely speak the same love language. And therefore, for me to speak my spouse's love language means I've got to learn to speak, to be comfortable in a different language. Which, he says beautifully, and many Torah sources, Jewish sources make the exact same point, if you're willing to change because of somebody else, that's the greatest way of showing love. Meaning, if you're a gift, you like gifts, and your spouse likes gifts. There's nothing wrong with that, but then gifts are very natural to you, and you don't have to extend yourself, you don't have to push yourself, you don't have to work hard to figure out what gift to get, and how to wrap, and how to do all the things of gift-giving. So it's great, it still fills the love tank. But when you speak a different language than your spouse does, that already says, I'm willing to do something only because you appreciate it. It's only because you appreciate that language that I'm willing to grow in that direction. That's the greatest single sign of love, aside from the thing itself, and the act itself, etc. But I'm willing to change. I'm willing to come closer to you, doing what you want me to do, not because I enjoy it, not because it's natural, not because it's what I grew up with, it's because you enjoy it, you appreciate it. It's a language that you speak. Another point, I think, an important point to make, and that is, I think this is his example, and that is someone visits a foreign country. They're a tourist, they're a businessman, whatever it is. They want to learn a certain amount of the lingo of the land. You don't become an expert, necessarily, certainly not overnight. And very often you can go to that foreign country, you can do your thing, you can do the touring, you can do the business, you can get by without being an expert. And that's, I think, an important understanding and approach also to using the five love languages. It doesn't mean you've got to be perfect. It's either all or nothing. That's not the way it works. If we can grow to understand what our partner's love language is, and then learn to speak that more and more and more and become better at it, that counts for a tremendous amount. That doesn't mean we have to be perfect in that language. It's not what I grew up with. It's not necessarily natural for me. It may be a struggle for me to remember and how and when, but the fact that I'm working on it, again, is a tremendous sign of love. Okay, so that's a little bit of an intro to the five love languages. I want to go through each of them, and then again, stop for questions, each of them with a little story, with an anecdote, with a little Talmud thrown in here and there, and then we'll stop for questions. So the first in our list is words of affirmation. And I think there's a great story in the Talmud that really illustrates the concept of words of affirmation and the power of words of affirmation. The Gemara talks about Akiva. I'm sure many of us are familiar with the man who later became Rabbi Akiva, the famous leader of the Jewish people. So Akiva was a very simple shepherd. He was an ignoramus. He was illiterate. He wasn't anything special. And the Gemara tells a story that he was walking in the woods and he saw water dropping on a rock, and the rock had an indentation because of the water. And he said to himself, if that water, which is so soft, can make an indentation on the rock, which is so hard, maybe Judaism, the ideas of the Torah, which are compared to water, can also make an impression on me, despite the fact that I'm just not with it, I'm illiterate, couldn't read and write. But he felt that maybe his tradition has something to say to him. And he goes on and becomes one of the most important central leaders in Jewish history. So, on the surface, it seems, from that story at least, that he's a self-made man. He had this event, seemingly small event in his life, and it turned him around. It's interesting that in 1954, a very important work came out by a person we're all familiar with, I'm sure, Abraham Maslow. The name of the book is Motivation and Personality.
And that's where he first introduces what he has become famous for, which is Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Which basically says, and today it's very often depicted as a triangle, apparently he never drew it that way, but if you Google it, you'll see the triangle, that there's certain needs that everybody has that need to be met first, before a person can really move up and meet higher level needs.
So the first and most basic we can all readily relate to are basic needs. Food, clothing, shelter. It's hard to build businesses if you don't have what to eat. You have to have the basics taken care of. Then safety, then love, feeling loved and appreciated by family, by friends. And then the top two are esteem, what he called esteem, and self-actualization. So again, his message to the world, which is a nugget that is really enshrined in modern day psychology, is that these, they are somewhat sequential. They need to be addressed sequentially for a person to really self-actualize and to really grow and to become. One needs to focus on the base of the triangle before they can move up. So I would, with that understanding, take a different look at Rabbi Kiva. Because when Rabbi Kiva came back with tens of thousands of students, and he was already the go-to man in the Jewish world. This is in the Roman era. He was like the leader of the Jewish people. He turns to the tens of thousands of people assembled, and he says the famous line, Shali v'shalachem shalah. Everything that I've accomplished and everything that you all have accomplished together with me are really to her credit, to his famous wife, Rachel. Because Rachel met this shepherd boy, and she wanted to marry him. And her rich father said, no way, you're not doing that. My girl, Jewish girl, there's no way you're marrying the shepherd boy who can't read and write. And she said, no, I see something in him. And she married him, and she built him up, and she sent him to yeshiva. And Rabbi Kiva later on, decades later, credits all of it to her. Because she spoke words of affirmation. She understood that there was tremendous potential in this Akiva. And if she together with him were able to bring that out and to appreciate that, and she would bring that out in him, allow him to understand what he's really got inside, he could become great. So through words of affirmation, now she spoke to him and she encouraged him and she pointed out the strength to him, that he became the great and famous Rabbi Akiva. So it's really Rachel, and he credits her with that. So it's not only, I think this piece from the Talmud is instructive, it's not just the connection that people can have, but it's just the growth that a couple can have together, that a family can have together, can, to a certain extent, be encouraged. The catalyst for that growth can come from the five love languages in general, in this example, words of affirmation. Think about children, think about coworkers, think about anyone really in your life, think about your own past experiences when a teacher, a coach, a parent pointed something out, a strength that you have that maybe you didn't fully appreciate, didn't really realize. I can think of several in my own life. When someone points that out that you care about, that just opens you up. That makes you really understand there's something here, and I can make something of this, which you may not have if it wasn't pointed out. So words of affirmation are powerful. Again, all the five love languages are powerful because it gives us the power, the strength to become who we can become. So that's just one story about words of affirmation. Quality time, the next one. Maybe first I'll just start with a story. This is a famous, well, he's a famous author, certainly. I don't know if this book is Mitch Albom, who wrote Tuesdays with Morrie, one of the more famous works. So this book really is a fascinating read that my wife encouraged me to read, and I am very thankful to that for her doing that. It's a very interesting work, and I don't want to ruin it, but he weaves the lives of two very different people together. Very interesting work. So it's really focused on Rabbi Albert Lewis and his career as a conservative rabbi. So some of his sermon vignettes make it into the book. So if I could just share one cute little vignette. Again, we're talking about quality time. So Rabbi Lewis, apparently this is a sermon he gave in 1958. And the story, short story goes, a little girl came home from school with a drawing she made in class. She danced into the kitchen where her mother was preparing dinner. Mom, guess what? She squealed, waving the drawing. Her mother never looked up. What? She said, tending to the pots.
guess what? The child repeated, waving the drawing. What? The mother said, tending to the plate. Mom, you're not listening. Sweetie, yes, I am. Mom, the child said, you're not listening with your eyes. So, from the mouth of babes, we often learn a tremendous amount. That's what quality time really is all about. And I would argue, and I suspect we'd all agree, that it's gotten harder and harder and harder. I mean, we all remember not that long ago, before we had internet in our houses, before we had smartphones in our pockets, before we had all the distractions that we have in our lives, and life was just simpler, and life was less busy and less distracted. So to truly be present with your partner, to be truly present with your kids, to truly be present with anyone you really care about, has gotten harder. And to listen with our eyes is not as simple as it once was. The pasuk, the verse in Deuteronomy, says a very interesting thing. It says when a young man and woman get married, he is not, certainly the norm then was for the man to be the one traveling, but this would apply certainly both ways. He was not allowed to travel for the first year of their marriage. Business affairs were put on hold. He had to stay home. And the Sefer HaChinuch, which explains mitzvot, says because he has to spend that quality time with his new wife so he could begin to understand her. To understand how she wants things done, how she wants to run her home, who is this lady that he just dedicated himself to for the rest of his life. So there's a mitzvah in our Torah, one of the 613, for him to put other things on hold and spend time with her. Now it's fascinating, fast forward 3,500 years, it's a research done by John Gottman, which I suspect many of you have heard of. John Gottman is a Jewish researcher in Seattle, who proudly wears his yarmulke on his television interviews. Anyway, he's done a tremendous amount of research in the area of marriage and relationships and love and dating and all this. And one of the principles, many, many books have been published by him, and one of the principles that he writes about is the fact that in a strong relationship, a husband follows his wife's lead. He understands her. He follows her lead, put it that way. He follows her lead in the home, and she sets the tone of the home, and that's a successful relationship. When it's forced the other way, not so much. So this idea of quality time, which again is codified in our Torah, is critical. It's critical not just for the time it's spent, but it's critical because of the information that's gathered, just the understanding of each other, and again, for the love of wife to really set the tone for the bias for the home. So spending that quality time is spending that time, as we said, being present to the person. Okay, receiving gifts. Purim is around the corner. It's actually a month from yesterday or today. And if you look at the story of Purim, it's fascinating. Because Haman, the villain in the story, notices that the Jews are mufusa mufura. The Jews are not unified. The Jews are a mess. They're infighting, they don't get along, they don't talk to each other. And that was his key. That was his cue to go and attack the Jewish people. Because he understood, on some level, that there is a God in the world, the God protects the Jews. But if the Jews aren't together, and unfortunately, thousands of years later, not much has necessarily changed. And we do come, rockets start flying into Israel, and there is a certain amount of unity that is created because of that. We should never need such reminders. But that was Haman's cue that there's an opportunity here to attack the Jewish people, which he was almost very successful in doing. The anecdote, which we're still doing today, the solution, so to speak, to this problem is Mishloach Manos, and Matanos Avyonim, sending gifts. We send gifts to each other, we send gifts to the poor. That's what we still do today, thousands of years later, on Purim. So that the problem of separation, this problem of lack of love and unity among the Jewish people as a whole, when the rabbis set it up, and Esther set it up as a holiday, and the mitzvot that would be carried on by us, again, till this very day, till next month, is giving gifts, is gift-giving. And the Mishnah, which is one of the basic books of rabbinic literature, tells us that if a person wants to get close to someone, give them something. Give them something they can use. Give them something they can appreciate. Give them something that can be a permanent trigger of your gift giving, we all appreciate, I think, and understand gifts are a very important piece of this. One point that many of the books on research, you know, about marriage talk about is that typically in a marriage there's going to be a spender and a saver. That's just normal. And if you're the saver and your job now is to give gifts to your partner, going back to where we started, that you got to learn. You got to stretch yourself and push yourself in that direction, despite maybe your natural tendency not to spend, but that's exactly what you need to do. And that's the biggest sign and show of love. It's not the flowers, it's not the chocolate, it's not whatever, the jewelry, it's the fact that you extended yourself in that direction and you're giving, despite the fact it may not be what's natural and comfortable for you. Okay, that's gift giving. Acts of service. 2 points about acts of service. I heard this Dvar Torah, this idea, years and years ago. I think it's a very, very, very beautiful idea. The rabbis point out that the Torah starts with chesed, with giving, and ends with chesed. It starts with giving when God gives clothes to Adam and to Eve. They eat from the tree of knowledge, where we're all familiar with, and they now understand and appreciate that they're naked. The whole creation is a fascinating book to study and to understand the story in depth. But in short, they now understood that they needed clothing, and God gives them clothing. And the Torah ends with chesed, where Hashem, God Himself, buries Moshe Rabbeinu. Fine. But the question is, what do you mean the Torah starts with chesed, by God giving Adam and Eve clothes? That's already, we're already well into the story by the time that happens. God created the world. That was an act of giving. He put all this stuff in it for you and me. I mean, there's a lot that happens way before Adam and Eve have, do what they did and need the... I mean, it's not where the Torah starts. What do you mean the Torah starts and says it? And also, we're already pointing that out. You can all read. What's the point of this message? And the answer is that true chesed, true giving, true acts of service are specifically when you don't want to, when you're not in the mood. Here, God gave them everything. Everything in the world is yours. Just don't touch that one tree. And they botched it. So, moments of fact, you messed it up, you fixed the problem. Deal with it. But Hashem comes along, God comes along and says, no, here, they had their own clothes, they gave him better clothes. Hashem stepped in, so to speak, when he wasn't, quote unquote, in the mood of helping, because they just fit the hand that feeds them, and did that chesed anyway. That's the message of this line in the Talmud. That it's not simply telling us how things start and how things end. We can read ourselves. The point is, it's not really the first, but it's the first real act of giving. It's the first act of giving when you're really not, your heart is not necessarily into it. Do it anyway. That act of chesed is spoken much, much more loudly in that situation. And then the last is a cute little story of a gentleman, a husband, sitting reading his newspaper, and his wife comes over with a piece of cake and says, "Happy anniversary." And he stops reading his newspaper and looks up in utter horror, thinking he forgot their anniversary. Any men in the room relate? He's mortified, and he's thinking, he says, "Wait a second, anniversary is in 3.5 months. She says, "Yeah, but it's been a year since I asked you to fix the cabinet." So he eats the cake and fixes the cabinet. Now, I remember I shared this story with a ladies group years ago, and like in unison, 3 or 4 ladies said, "He ate the cake?" I mean, he ate the cake first? Like, how could I? Okay, so men are still men, they want their food, but he ate the cake, and so this is a great example, a little vignette, about a wife, a very highly emotionally intelligent woman over here, communicating with her husband about an act of service that she really wanted done. Okay, and then last but not least is, what are we holding with time here? Okay, is physical touch. So Chapman in the book makes the point that his focus here at least is not intimate physical touch, but it's casual physical touch between spouse, between couple. And that's an important distinction to make on some level. The casual, the hug, the kiss, just the casual physical touch that the husband and wife share on a regular basis And it's important, I think, here maybe than any other area to point out that some, again, the different people speak different languages. And with our own children, for example, you see very clearly from birth that one child wants to be held a lot and hugged and just always have that physical touch. And another kid, just, you know, when they want it, they'll come get it, but it's just not something they really desire. And that's something parents and spouses need to be sensitive to. Where is that love language in that person's list, in that person's hierarchy? Now, I think it's also very important to make this point
that this is an area where the world bombards us, I think, about the intimate part of relationships, and the messages certainly young people today are getting are coming from all the wrong places. The messages are, you know, we don't have to go through the sources that they're getting from movies, from internet, but they're typically not getting them from any truly healthy sources, from adults in their lives that they respect and can really guide them. And I think many of us grow up really not having a good, clear idea of our view, a personal view, a Jewish view towards this whole arena. So I just want to share one idea from a larger class that I give. The class is called Sexuality and Marshmallows, the Jewish Approach to Intimacy, which is several part series, which I've been giving to high school kids for many years. And just as an aside, it's amazing when you speak to a young person, 15, 16, 17 year old, about this, about sexuality, about physical touch. You know, you could be struggling to get the other information in them. But when you start talking about this, they are fixated because they struggle with this regularly. They hear about it regularly from a variety of sources. And they have a sense, I think, like most of us, that there's something missing. Right? MTV does not have a monopoly on the truth about intimacy. And the internet and HBO, all the messages that we get, there isn't something really missing. So when you explain to them, the boys and girls, it's just amazing to see the light go on in their heads. So just one idea. And that is, this is based on a point that made by Dr. Norman Lamb, who's an amazing author, in one of his books called Hedge of Roses. So he says, if you look at history, you see something fascinating. You see the Greek and Roman approach to pleasure and to sexuality in particular was do whatever you want. The whole Greek God system, the whole mythology system is based really on this. It's just do whatever you want, it's fine. And the gods were more corrupt than they were. That was their approach. If you look at what happened next in world history, the church came along and said, this isn't working. This hedonism is not working. So the whole story of Hanukkah is just simply not working. It's physical focus, it's the new statues, it's all the stuff that represented. This is wrong. So that the church went very much the opposite direction. Bipolar, the polar opposite of the Greek and Roman approach was the Christian approach, which is sexuality and pleasure in general should be minimized. Celibacy is really the ideal. That was their approach. Norman Lamb, Dr. Lamb points out that if you think about Western culture, we have largely taken both, despite the fact that they're water and oil. I mean, they really are opposites. A Western man has to a certain extent taken both and put them together in a very uncomfortable mix. So that the messages that we are giving young people, or young people are getting, very often is, do whatever you want, but it's really sinful, it's really negative, it's really not, we don't use the word holiness and sexuality in the same sentence. The Torah approach, which is delineated again and again and again and again in a myriad of places, disagrees strongly with both approaches. And it's really what Judaism is all about. Judaism is all about taking the physical and elevating it. It's not that physical is bad. It's not like you do whatever you want with physical. There's no boundaries at all, which are the two systems we talked about before. But it's elevating. It's taking physicality. It's taking pleasure and elevating it. I always say to my team, party with a purpose. There's the party, there's the fun, there's the enjoyment, but it's always with a purpose. It's always with some boundaries. It's always with something uniquely human about it. So that's the beginning of a much larger conversation. And he doesn't get, you know, he's certainly not going to get into this in the book, but it's an important idea, I think, just to open our you know, to open the conversation, the dialogue about this. that there's a lot to learn about this issue, and we shy away from it sometimes. It's a sensitive topic, and it's uncomfortable, and et cetera, but it's hugely important. I mean, it's just the core of a human being
is this understanding. Okay, so let's stop now for a few minutes and take questions.
We're often taught doing to others as you would have done unto you. And in point of fact, I think a lot of the times it's probably more appropriate to do unto others as they would have done unto themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds like one of the things you're sort of emphasizing here, emphasized in this, is don't try to give those things that make you happy.
Right.
But try to find out what the things are that make the other person
right.
happy. But that's very, very difficult for us because we tend to think in terms of the way we work, the way our minds work, is we put ourselves in the other person's place. And
right.
we're told to do that. Put yourself in their place. How would you feel?
Right.
And in fact, it sounds like what you're saying and what this is telling us is that we shouldn't do that. We should not put ourselves in their place. We should put themselves in their place.
Right.
We should figure out what... And that seems to me both harder and somewhat counter to a lot of the tradition and explanation that we've received in the past.
Interesting. Okay, that's a fascinating point. I think what you're hitting on is the verse says, "Ve'ahavta re'acha kamocha," you should love your fellow like yourself. And the question you're struggling with is, what does it mean like yourself? The flip side, the Talmud says, "Ma'aseh lach," what's hateful to you, don't do to somebody else. The Talmud flips it and makes it negative. So I think in the context of your question, that's easy to understand. The second half, at least, is easy to understand. If you don't like it, if it's distasteful to you, then that's not something you should do to somebody else. So that almost doesn't apply to the five love languages almost at all. It just means avoid being honest, being all the basics of what you really abhor, the things you should never think about doing to someone else. So going back to the beginning, v'ahavta re'acha kamocha, there's a lot of discussion. What does that mean, kamocha? What does that mean, like yourself? So certainly, yes, exactly. Based on the way we are understanding it, kamocha means if you're in their shoes, but being them, with their makeup, with their issues, with their... And is there a little bit of unlearning to do here? I mean, yeah, could be. True empathy means figuring out what that person wants and needs. That's really what empathy, empathizing with them, and as very often it's very different from person to person. Is it always easy to do? No. So the answer is yes.
You're right. So just to do that on that question, on discussion, your statement, if it is counterintuitive, how literally do we help ourselves? Is it a no refrigerator? In your experience, people who are effectively making changes, how
is that? That's a great question. First and foremost, again, it's a simple idea. I think this idea is quite simple, quite straightforward. We can memorize the five if we wanted to. Figuring out what our own is, hopefully it's not that hard. The quizzes may help a little bit. And then you could compare notes afterwards with your spouse. So the foundation, the beginning, is the easy part. As you're saying, it's actualizing it day in and day out. There's no question that that's the hard part. And I think that's why it's so important that behavioral change, ethics of our fathers, for example, right? The Mishnah that teaches us about interpersonal relationships is very simple stuff. I mean, you read it compared to other rabbinic literature and you think like, did they miss something? And the answer is no. It has to be simple. If you're going to change and grow, it has to be very, very simple. You get more and more complex, typically you lose it. So then the question becomes, yes, what tricks can we employ to make sure that those ideas carry? So certainly a little note, for example, or a reminder, email reminder, phone reminder of, this should be done from time to time for my spouse. Simple things to remind, sticker, a post-it note in the bathroom and, in the window, in the mirror. Just things that keep us focused because, let's face it, when we deal with other people, the biggest problem is getting distracted, getting off the mark. We're not like typically clueless or, we have an idea, we just get, life takes over and back to square one. So, it's an excellent question. The answer has to, each person has to figure out what things can they do, can they use, what interventions can they use to keep them focused on, I now know my partner's love language is A, this and that. How do I, on a regular basis, relatively regular basis,
speak that language to my spouse. And it's, I mean, it can be very simple if you allow it to be.
Let me throw out sort of a follow-up to that. So one is, do you find it helpful for partners to actually just be outright and communicate and say, you know, I need more of, like, I know about myself that I need X, you know, and say, look, can I have more, can I,
right.
you know, I need more words of affirmation.
Right. That is certainly something he talked quite a bit about, Chapman, about simply sitting down and doing that. One spouse will probably appreciate that more than the other, depending on you know, where they're coming from. This is
a
community.
Awkward when you say, "I need more gifts."
Right.
Right. You're going
to
email with the registry on it.
And here's the list. You know, I'm registered at these stores, and I'm. Right.
Right. On the other hand, especially gift giving, a lot of men would appreciate a list. You know, it's just because we don't know what to do sometimes. So,
before we leave, all the lines.
Open a registry at Allen's store.
There you go.
You can pay for her gifts.
But isn't all of these things are gifts?
In a sense,
really,
yes.
In a sense,
yes.
You know, if I say I really like it when you help me out, and I find that that's a gift for me, because it takes some of the pressure off of me, so it is a gift.
Absolutely.
But when you do something like that, and then you turn around and explain to yourself how hard it was for them to do it, it takes some of that away.
Right. That's something you shouldn't.
So that's
yeah.
something you need to also
maybe
be aware
keep
of.
Right.
The things that shouldn't necessarily be shared. You know, the sweat and the tears that went into it, you know.
Right.
On the other hand, hopefully they appreciate, you know, the other partners appreciate that. So, yeah, sometimes communicating it one way or the other is important. Now, maybe a sit-down, you know, here's the list, is not necessarily the most comfortable way of doing it, but there are other ways, hint, leaving a note, and I really appreciated it. You know, one of his stories, Chapman, is of, I forget the names in the story, but she turns to her husband on Tuesday and says, I would really appreciate if you did the lawn in the garage before Thursday when the, you know, O'Nallys are coming for dinner. You know, that kind of thing. So, you know, sometimes just needs to be, especially acts of service, maybe
that'll
just need to be,
service, right?
Yeah, yeah, just needs to be, you know, said straight out and appreciated for what it is. Yes, ma'am. Something I think takes a few years in most relationships to figure out, that men are not only not mind readers, we're pretty thick sometimes. Okay, Rabbi Heller.
Following up on that question, so Michelle sort of asked, so aren't they all gifts? So talk a little bit about sort of gifts as a category outside of financial value, and also sort of gifts and acts of service. How would you differentiate between the two of those?
Good question. Okay. So, I mean, there's no question that there's a certain amount of bleed between them. And I've heard people suggest the six, you know, I don't think we need to necessarily lose sleep over. But the quality of gifts really is that there's a permanent trigger. There's something there. Well, it's not even permanent necessarily. The chocolates are long gone. But it's something physical. It's something that is transferred. It's something, you know, it's just something physical. Whereas an act of service is, you know, taking care of something, taking the stress, as you said before, away, which a gift could do also. I mean, if you get a gift that helps, you know, things around the house. And so sometimes there, you know, folks sometimes just like stuff. They're into stuff, and it's very clear to them, gifts is my thing. And sometimes, no, it's more useful, more utilitarian type stuff. If you get me a gift that will help me accomplish my whatever easier, faster, then that's a good gift. That's already bleeding into active service. I'm not sure if I answered the question, but, you know, sometimes there is a little bit of bleed, and I'm not sure if that's something, you know, we should necessarily worry about.
I think we've actually gotten the other question here. Are there other questions from the group? Yeah, go ahead.
So, this book talks about a primary love language.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I actually can define that for me, and I asked my wife when I first read the text a long time ago because I had no clue, and she actually told me, so then I got that one.
That's great.
It's actually, you talk about a hierarchy, and there probably actually is, because as I'm applying this, there's a primary need, and then there's probably going to be a second and a third that come pretty strong, and then the fourth and fifth that are totally, would totally be off the mark, like when the guy brings you flowers and you're on a gift person, you're like going, that's not my thing, are you
right,
not?
Right.
Get that out of my face and alert.
And that's a very good point. And the, when you take the quiz, it's like every other assessment that you take. You know, if it seems valid, it makes sense to you, actually take it, great. If it's not, then... But certainly in taking that quiz, I think very often folks see that. They'll see, different things in clusters, if you will. And that's good to know. I mean, that's important information. Remember, one gentleman took it years ago and told me that he's all, midline. He's all five or six for all of them. So on one hand, that's easy. His wife, pick any of the five and good to go. But most folks, I think, generally will have one or two, rise to the top. But there'll be some clustering. Yeah, 100%. And then the question only is, how able are we to focus on two, three, four at any given, I don't know about you, but if I have one or two, that's already pretty good. So you can focus on one or two things.
Other questions?
Yeah.
In the past, when we brought up that we shared what our life edges are, since then, what it actually changed? Is that possible?
I have heard that from folks, yes. I have heard that. What's interesting...
The question version of the statement was, can your love languages change over time?
Right. So the answer is, I believe, just anecdotally, and I can't say there's a research that I know of to support this, but yeah, I think the answer is yes. That as people change and attitudes and maybe interests and mature and whatever, certain things rise to a level they weren't at before. That could very well be for a variety of reasons. Life gets more hectic, maybe acts of service become more important, whereas gifts were more important before, the less important. We can come up with reasons, I think, why things might change. I mean, the strength and maybe the weakness at the same time, which is usually how life works, right? Your strength is your weakness. Of the five love languages, he's not huge into research. So if you're into that, Gottman is the opposite. Gottman is very cerebral, very research-based, very...
A lot of math.
I mean, he's really into that kind of stuff. I enjoy reading his stuff, but it's not, I like the simplicity of Chapman. So he doesn't, I can call him and ask him, but I really doubt he's done that type of research. Things have changed, and he just says, this works, he's done it, and he's worked with thousands and thousands of couples, he's sold millions and millions and millions of books. The publisher's been telling me 5 million for like 5 years, and that's just simply, it's just an astronomical amount these days. So if it works, use it.
Lisa, did you have a question?
Yeah.
When we got married, I was, we had friends that were going to Pre-Cana or with the Catholic churches around their preparation or other church programs, and there was really nothing for Jewish couples. I mean, that's sort of like something in Jewish family career service was really not a couple. We're still here to tell the telltale. But what is the Jewish community doing with that here? Intro about how you all came to maybe offer those kinds of things.
You're staying at it.
I'm gonna say that question was a plant. I asked her to ask that question, and I'll give you the $20 later. Now that's a perfect segue, really, to the conclusion, and we do have to wrap up in a few minutes. And that is that what Rabbi Heller and I have noticed, what conversations I've had with people from all over the country, really, Canada, L.A., there's a lot of folks doing, in the Jewish world, I mean, there's a lot of folks doing different things. There's rabbis, there's rebbetzins, there's mental health professionals, and then an insurance broker who does something. I mean, there's a lot of different folks doing a little bit of work in this direction, marriage enrichment, marriage education, relationship education. But what I have found, in contrast to the Christian world, as you just pointed out, is there's really nothing solid. There's nothing unified. There's nothing well thought out, well funded. It's just a little here, a little there. People's trying to do whatever they can. And that's a problem. I think it's a real problem because we live in a world very different than it was 20, 30 years ago where the Jewish family and Jewish marriage is under attack like families in general. And a lot of that is simply due to the fact that we're not talking about it, that we're not educating ourselves about these issues. That we just all assume, you know, it's worked for thousands of years, boy meets girl, they go off and they live happily ever after. And on some level, that was probably true until recently. That's no longer the case. So that we do need to address this issue in a very thoughtful, very methodical way. I mean, one of the questions I ask groups is, you know, how many have been at well-funded multimedia presentations of marriage enrichment? And no hands go up. I mean, no one's ever been, right? And then you ask, how many have been watching TV since they're 3 or 4? And everyone's hand goes. So, and if you can't watch an hour or two of TV and not see some type of relationship and some type of dynamic and some type of message, and I don't know what the statistics are these days about how much TV and YouTube our kids are imbibing by the time they're 18 or 22.
Billion views of YouTube.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's just...
And that's just Gangnam Style.
Yeah, I might have shifted from TV to internet. But the bottom line is, we're still taking in a tremendous amount of well-funded multimedia messages about relationships. The only problem is the messages are all wrong. The messages are all wrong. So, and you can't say this doesn't affect people's behavior because the entire marketing industry, billions and millions of dollars are being spent to change your behavior. I mean, to sell you stuff mixed into this...
So it's a real problem. It's a real issue, and we need to address it. I think as strongly as we possibly can,
and that's where you all come in. And that is a take home from all this, ladies and gentlemen. Is not only to take home the book, and I hope you'll read it, and you'll discuss it, and you'll share it with each other, but is also when you finish reading the book, share it with somebody else. Give it to your brother-in-law. Give it to your mother. Give it to someone. Allow them to read it. Pass it around. That's certainly one piece of this. Another is to help us to do this type of work, which means to call other folks, call some other synagogues, schools, etc., and say this is a type of program that we really want to do. We're really interested in talking with high schools around the country, with college age kids around the country, with synagogues, with temples, with really any Jewish audience that's interested in this type of and everyone's interested in relationships. I mean, it really is a basic core issue that I would agree is really not being addressed in the Jewish world. We're hesitant to go to church and hear their message. I mean, it is a very personal type of message. It's not, you know, there's a lot of other things you can go to a non-religious or Christian source even, but when you're talking about marriage and relationships and family and all those values, even though it's not specific to mitzvot and your behavior, you know, what customs you're going to have at your home, that's a separate, but just a Jewish flavor to the whole conversation, I think, is important to most of us. So, the challenge I want to throw down to everyone here is to help. It's really to help create, there's been many movements throughout Jewish history that address specific issues. This needs to become one of them. We need to really create a marriage enrichment, relationship enrichment movement, which truly helps shift our thinking. And I think we can really, truly change the course of a lot of families by doing this. Because once there are already some serious issues, there's therapy, there's counseling, there's a lot of good things, but let's face it, that's, you know, pound of, ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Any final questions?
I just have to amend what I said.
Yes.
3 billion views on YouTube per day.
Oh my gosh.
Sorry.
Yes. Yeah.
Of whatever.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Have you in your home, you do something special for your wife every week when it's Shabbat, using the Isha style, elevating your wife, and you always thank her separately in English, for a beautiful meal or for different things. And I think most people that are not Orthodox, and you can disagree with me if you want, I don't know, don't know about that and don't know to do that. And I think that is something really, really special.
Well, certainly Eish Chayil is an example, I think, of words of affirmation that is a custom. No, I can't think, I don't almost call it a halacha, but it's a custom that many, many, many Jews for many, many...
And not just necessarily Orthodox.
Yeah, certainly. Across the Jewish world, I suspect, singing Eish Chayil, it's a beautiful, you can read the English text, it's just a beautiful song that King Solomon wrote, and it is dedicated to the Jewish woman. That's an example of words of affirmation that are kind of part of the custom of, you know, the fabric of Judaism. And there are many examples like that. You know, if you had another 3 or 4 hours, we can go through some of those.
When you're talking about in terms of approaching college kids and high school kids, one day, I think where the need is here. The need is for those of us that have the kids that are maybe going to be going into high school or maybe going to go to college, so that we can have that. That custom that you talk about, yeah, when you say it, okay, yeah, I remember having heard about it at some point in my life, but because I didn't grow up with it. And so my children aren't going to grow up with it. And I think that's what we're missing. I think that those of us that have the younger children now are the people that missed out on what the generation before us got from our parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're worried about the kids of college and the younger, we're the ones that are lost. We're the ones that don't have that part of the tradition. If we didn't get it from our parents, there's nowhere for us to go to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe any more...
parents of young kids. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very true. There's no question about it. I mean, preschool, for example, has, like we're doing today, kids are in preschool, and some of the parents are here with us right now. That's a great model. You know, the kids get the education while the parents also are sitting and talking around coffee about some of these issues. And some of the customs, you know, it's a great example, something that can be inserted into one's life. It takes 3 minutes a week, but your kids grow up with it, and they remember it, and it's a constant... Now, again, simplicity is the secret. Right. That's
let me throw out one other point, because I know we need to wrap up the formal part. We can stay in schmooze for a few
Absolutely,
minutes.
Absolutely, yes.
Which is that... our focus today has really been on marriage, but it's actually worth thinking about these love languages in terms of types of other relationships as well. Right? So stereotypically, I may be talking to a kid who's like, my parents didn't love me. That is probably not actually literally true, right? But however they expressed their affection, right, is not in a way that their child really needed or appreciated, right?
Right.
You know, you have the one child that needs... Rabbi Paul gives the example, the kid who needs to be held, the kid who doesn't want to be held, the kid who needs to be told how great they are, the kid who that makes them uncomfortable.
Right.
Or even in a work environment, although physical touch in a work environment, like litigation might ensue, but nevertheless, there are, you can think about, you know, even in family relationships in terms of, you know, more distant family, that these are principles that you can reflect with. I actually did a sermon once talking about the five love languages as they relate to our relationship with God.
Hmm.
Now, physical touch with God is sort of not something we do as Jews, but you can actually go through how we relate to God and see each of these sort of as part of our pattern of our spiritual lives. So there's a lot of ways, and Rabbi Pollack actually does a seminar which is much more extensive, much more in-depth, which if there's interest we may try to do here as well in the coming months. I want to thank Rabbi Pollack for coming today and sharing his time with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.